From the Voice of America, this is International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. 2019 has come and gone, and on today's special recorded program, we take a look at the year that was, revisiting some of the major stories that helped shape the last 12 months.
A violence-plagued, hotly contested election, a mysterious insurgency, and two deadly cyclones plagued Mozambique.
Yes, let's go back to this time a year ago when the former Prime Minister Theresa May had managed to strike a Brexit deal.
We take a look at the last year in those stories, plus U.S. politics, the climate, and a whole lot more. While U.S. President Donald Trump has a tense relationship with NATO allies, he seems to have warmer ties with a number of non-democratic leaders, including North Korea's Kim Jong-un, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and Russian President Vladimir Putin. But despite Trump's approach, a recent survey indicates a large majority of Americans support a traditional U.S. foreign policy based on strong military alliances, free trade, and promoting democracy and human rights abroad. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports from the State Department.
President Donald Trump has established his own unorthodox approach to U.S. foreign policy. He often has harsh words for NATO and other traditional U.S. allies, evident when he blasted Canada's leader, who was caught on video at the recent NATO London summit, apparently making fun of Trump.
Well, he's two-faced.
Yet, he often praises authoritarian leaders, such as Russian President Vladimir Putin and Chinese President Xi Jinping, whom he called a good man in a tough business in a tweet. Also notably different from his predecessors are Trump's beautiful letters and visits with North Korea's Kim Jong-un.
And I think that you will have a tremendous future with your country, a great leader.
Trump seems to have a real affinity for authoritarian strongmen, says Francis Brown, who worked at the National Security Council under both the Obama and Trump administrations.
I think oftentimes these strongmen flatter President Trump personally, and he likes that. The problem is that the rest of the U.S. government is trying to push back against strongmen with anti-democratic tendencies.
And polls indicate most Americans have more traditional foreign policy views. 7 in 10 Americans. The 2019 Chicago Council survey shows 78% think the U.S. should maintain or increase its support for NATO, and almost 60% believe promoting democracy and human rights abroad makes the U.S. safer. So it would appear Americans soundly reject a retreat from global alliances, says former U.S. Ambassador to NATO Ivo Dalder.
Only 20% of Americans think what the president thinks, which is that they're beneficial only for the allies. The same is true on trade.
Asked if Trump's foreign policy will matter to American voters in 2020, one expert said some might feel it comes down to character.
I think that perhaps this presidential election round, more than others, people will, I think, be judging just the character and the way the president imports himself to our allies in the world.
Trump's approach to foreign policy may not be decisive at the ballot box next year, given that Americans cite health care, the economy, and immigration as their top issues. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
Now, speaking of the ballot box, 2019 saw the 2020 presidential election campaign kick into high gear with an unprecedented number of Democratic Party candidates. But by far, the top political story out of Washington has been the impeachment of U.S. President Donald Trump. We spoke with VOA's national correspondent, Jim Malone, about the events of 2019 and what's to come in the upcoming election year. So if we take a look at the impeachment of U.S. President Donald Trump, the last time this happened was in the 90s with Bill Clinton. This is a once in a seemingly generation event. How has this impeachment, looking back over this past year, really shaped American politics?
Well, you know, there is that question. And you mentioned how frequently, historically, we have impeached presidents. And one thing we have to note now, the last one was 20 years ago, but within the last 45 years, we've had three impeachment efforts.
Right.
So between 1868 and 1974, we didn't have any. So one general byproduct of this and American democracy and our political polarization moving ahead is a question: will presidential impeachments become more of a political tool if the opposition party controls the Congress? We'll have to watch that moving forward. But in a sense, the impeachment saga involving President Trump, it always seemed to be brewing on the back burner of the stove, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. We had the Mueller report. To some extent, politically, that fizzled out for the Democrats. And the irony here is that the very day that Robert Mueller testified before Congress, sort of putting an end to that saga, the very next day was the infamous phone call between President Trump and the Ukrainian president. So it was a jumping off point, the president kind of stumbling into the next controversy, seemingly not minding what had happened just before him. And again, Democrats are unified against President Trump, but as we've seen during this impeachment battle, the president seems to be able to always rally Republicans to his side. It's kind of a 50-50 country, and that's what the polls show.
Speaking of the polls, speaking of the 50-50 country, what does that show about the divisiveness in American politics between Republicans, between Democrats, as we move towards the 2020 election cycle?
One thing we're seeing is that, sadly, and this is a trend that's been building for years, facts seem to matter less than political party loyalty. Or in the case of President Trump, it's not even loyalty to the Republican Party. It's really loyalty to him. And he has been able to basically rebrand the Republican Party as the party of Trump. He's known as a brander. Mm-hmm. That was his forte in business for many years. But now it's become a litmus test for any Republican. And you get these rather strange situations where Republicans will argue about the truth. What is the truth? What do they see? And, you have a few Republicans who will argue, well, perhaps what the president did was inappropriate or not the best thing to do, but his actions did not rise to the level of impeachment. That's one argument that can be made. But so many Republicans now are put in a box of blindly following the president, and it just leads to this political, it's beyond polarization. It's a tribalization of our political parties. And I don't know how we undo that anytime soon.
Now, as we move into 2020, we have the primaries coming up for the Democrat candidates. When do they take place? And because we had this immense field, 26 candidates at one time, can we expect to see a whittling of those away?
We have seen a winnowing down. And at one time, yes, more than 25. Now we're technically down to maybe 15 or so. But in terms of true candidates who have a shot, it's a lot smaller number. The latest Democratic debate in December had only 7 participants. And the debate was a lot more interesting. There was more time for the candidates to engage one another. I think that's the trend we're going to see moving forward. One of the reasons that debate was so intense was because the voting is coming up. The first votes will be cast in Iowa on February 3rd.
Jim Malone is VOA's national correspondent. Thank you very much for spending the day with us.
My pleasure.
After more than 3 years of debate over Brexit, the process of Britain leaving the European Union, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is tasked with trying to unite a country driven by disagreements over how, when, or even whether the UK should leave the EU. The debate has fractured towns, villages, and even families. I spoke with London-based reporter Henry Ridgewell about the divisive topic. Henry, can you kind of walk us through why Brexit is going to take place in 2020 when it should have taken place some time ago in 2019?
Yes, let's go back to this time a year ago when the former Prime Minister Theresa May had managed to strike a Brexit deal with Europe. And everybody thought at that point it was just going to be a matter of weeks or months until that deal was ratified and Britain would leave. But British lawmakers had other ideas. And the first time that that Brexit deal was put to a vote by Theresa May was on January the 15th, 2019. And it was defeated by a record amount. 432 lawmakers voted against it versus 202 voting for it. A record defeat for a sitting government. But Theresa May didn't give up then. She tried again 2 weeks later, having tried to seek some further compromises from the EU, having tried to convince other lawmakers to back her. She lost again by 149 votes. So it became pretty clear that she was not going to get this Brexit deal through the House of Commons in any shape or form, really. And she had to go back to Brussels, explain to them what had happened, and agree to an extension to the Brexit process. That was a six-month extension, which took us up to October. But it became pretty clear that Theresa May wasn't going to get her vision of Brexit through. And really, that was the death knell of her premiership in Britain. She resigned on the 7th of June, and that triggered a leadership contest within the Conservative Party. And the rest is history, really, as they say. Boris Johnson won that leadership contest. You'll remember back at the beginning of September, he tried to take Parliament out of the equation. He tried to suspend Parliament altogether to ram his vision of Brexit through. The Supreme Court in Britain ruled that that was illegal, forcing him to come back to the House of Commons. And he then had to agree to another Brexit extension. It was supposed to happen on October the 31st. It was extended until January the 31st. After much to and froing, Boris Johnson managed to secure an election, the one thing he was pushing for. And then, of course, in December, Boris Johnson won that election with a big majority of 80 MPs. And so finally, after several years, we have clarity. Britain, it seems, will be leaving on January the 31st.
Given that there was such a tight election, a narrow margin for pro-Brexit during that referendum, which seems an eternity ago, did people really think that getting a deal, a divorce deal done with Brussels would be this complicated?
I think those who knew the machinations of Brussels and Westminster well did predict this level of difficulty. I think the way that Brexit was sold during the referendum, of course, it had to be simplified for people to vote on it. It was a binary referendum, in or out. And it would be impossible to explain the intricacies of European and Westminster politics. But, of course, when somebody votes to leave the European Union and the politicians have promised it, they expect it to happen. But the reality is, of course, that Britain has been part of the European Union for more than 40 years. And so trying to, first of all, extract itself, because that's all that's been happening for the past 3.5 years, is Britain trying to get out, is going to take a lot of time. What we've still got to come is the future relationship. How are we going to work things out from here?
Henry Ridgewell is in London. Thank you very much for taking time out of your day to join us.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
This past year has seen a series of protests from Hong Kong to Chile, from Sudan to Iran. In more than a dozen countries, citizens have taken to the streets to air grievances, and many have gotten results. VOA United Nations correspondent Margaret Bashir looks at a year of discontent.
In France, protesters put on their yellow vests and demanded better pay and an end to rising prices. In Sudan, the people brought down the 40-year regime of a genocidal dictator. In Haiti, they demanded the president's resignation and the prosecution of corrupt officials. And in Hong Kong, demonstrators started by standing up to the Chinese authorities over an extradition law and expanded their demands to include more democracy.
The older generations have failed tackling the biggest crisis humanity has ever faced.
Even school children have taken to the streets, demanding that adults take better care of the planet. In these countries and on the streets of Iraq, Lebanon, Ecuador, Iran, and elsewhere, citizens are saying enough and demanding a change to business as usual. The UN Secretary General has called on governments to listen to the real problems of their people.
It is clear that there is a growing deficit of trust between people and political establishments and rising threats to the social contract. And the world is also wrestling with the negative impacts of globalization and new technologies, which have increased inequalities within societies.
In response, some governments have tried to address grievances, while others use a heavy hand to try to keep power. In Iraq and Iran, hundreds of protesters have been killed by aggressive security forces. While protesters have been overwhelmingly peaceful, some in France, Chile, Ecuador, Bolivia, and Hong Kong have vandalized and looted property.
They have a right to peacefully protest. Governments, unfortunately, have been, in many cases, using excessive force, arresting people arbitrarily, sometimes even killing them, murdering them. That is illegal. The authorities who are responsible for the decisions and the killings should be held accountable, but also protesters need to behave responsibly.
Experts say protesters are less afraid.
The main thing that we see in many of these places is the break of the fear barrier. People are now unafraid to go out in the street and criticize these politicians, something in the past used to be taboo.
Diwashi says in many cases it is now the politicians who fear the power of the people. Much of that power comes from organizing through social media, which is both a powerful tool and a vulnerability as governments cut communication networks.
Governments have realized that internet shutdowns are a great way to make it difficult for protesters to organize, but we've also seen that they still organize. You can't stop them.
As 2020 approaches, there are no signs these social media-fueled protest movements are slowing down. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
2019 was a tough year for the Southern African nation of Mozambique, with a violent, disputed election campaign, two devastating cyclones, a shadowy insurgency, an ongoing corruption scandal, and a visit by the Pope, in which he attempted to bring this battered nation together. As the coastal nation looks towards 2020, with a major multi-billion-dollar ExxonMobil natural gas deal hanging in the air, what lies ahead? And can this fractured nation be put back together? VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
A violence-plagued, hotly contested election, a mysterious insurgency, and two deadly cyclones plagued Mozambique this year. But a historic ceasefire deal between the government and opposition and a visit from the Pope also spread messages of peace and healing. 2019 has been a whirlwind year for the Southern African nation, and analysts say the plot will only thicken in 2020.
And of course, all of this takes place against the backdrop of this expected massive incoming windfall, which will come in the form of revenues through the liquid natural gas deposits up in northern Mozambique. So, you know, this is a contestation not just for political power in Mozambique. This is also a contestation for the control over what could be a vast reserve of wealth for the country in the next 20 years. So really the stakes are only going to get higher from here as well.
Mozambique's opposition claimed massive fraud in the October re-election of President Filipe Nyusi, which authorities deny. But the shadowy Islamist insurgency brewing in the rural north is also a main concern, says the Democratic Movement of Mozambique's Lutero Simango.
We are facing so many problems. We are facing the problem of militarization that is taking place in the north of Mozambique. I'm saying the Cabo Delgado province. And at this moment that we are speaking here, we are having militarization in the center of the central country in Mozambique, in the region of Sofia Manica.
Observers worry that the contested election may drive Mozambicans further apart. But the ruling Mozambique Liberation Front, FRELIMO, won 73% of the votes this time, compared to under 52% in the last polls. Masterson says that shows FRELIMO still has a great deal of support, though there are concerns about the numbers.
I think that the problems really started once we saw the aggregated numbers of the registration there, which really set the platform for an election where distrust was high, concerns about the procedural sort of and the technical aspects of the elections were elevated.
Opposition politician Simango, who claims the poll was not free and fair, puts it a bit differently.
When the people's will is not respected, when the people's will is not valued, when the people's will is not taken in consideration, you are creating a situation of an illegitimate government.
Frelimo has held power since 1975, but was also one of the key brokers in the August peace deal that brought an end to decades of conflict. And that's a message that even the Pope touted when he visited the nation in September as part of a three-nation Africa tour. Peace, reconciliation, and hope. Three things that Mozambique badly needs to get through this trying time. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
According to a new estimate, global carbon dioxide emissions rose by 0.6% this year. That's at a time when scientists say the world needs to sharply cut greenhouse gas emissions in order to stave off the worst of climate change. There was a glimpse of good news in the data, though. Burning coal for energy is the single largest source of CO2, and coal use declined a bit this year. Some experts say a global shift away from the dirty fuel is underway. VOA Steve Barragona has more.
This year, three of the country's top 10 coal producers went bankrupt. They were the latest casualties of an industry in decline. U.S. coal production is down more than a third from its 2008 peak, and it's expected to keep falling. Kentucky Energy and Environment Secretary Charles Snavely is a former coal executive. He delivered a grim prognosis for the industry at a conference in May.
I think that the risk is more to the downside than the upside. And if we're already projecting a significant decrease over time, I think that it will probably be worse than that.
President Donald Trump campaigned in 2016 on reviving the coal industry. He has loosened pollution regulations that he says are holding the industry back.
How about we give that to the miners? Right?
But coal-burning power plants are closing across the country anyway. Advances in drilling have made natural gas cheaper, and the cost of wind and solar power have plunged. It's happened faster than expected, says University of Wyoming economist Robert Godby.
Market forces have moved the coal market to a place most of us didn't anticipate in a really short period of time.
And coal industry jobs have not recovered since Trump took office. The shifting market is one reason emissions from coal worldwide were down almost 1% this year, says Global Carbon Project Chair Rob Jackson at Stanford University.
One thing we're seeing is a really rapid drop in coal use, both here in the United States and also in Europe. I mean, both places, coal use for this year alone is down about 10%, which is just really surprising.
But coal use increased this year in India and in China, the world's largest coal consumer by far. That nearly canceled out the declines elsewhere. And both countries plan to build more coal plants. That raises concerns about future CO2 emissions. But those plants may not get much use. China especially has already built more plants than it uses, says Tim Buckley with the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. So in other
words, every coal-fired power plant is only being used every second day on average. So you are really just building idle new capacity that's surplus, redundant to the country's needs.
But even as coal declines, greenhouse gas emissions from burning oil keep climbing, and natural gas use is soaring. That's bad news for the climate, Jackson says.
I think the offsets, the decreases in coal in countries like the United States and Europe just aren't enough to stabilize global emissions and ultimately drive them down.
To really tackle climate change, he says, the world has to get serious about cutting all fossil fuels. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to a special recorded international edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our production staff, Nadia Taha, our director, engineer, Mr. Sidrak Franklin, and our managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, thank you very much for spending part of your day with us. You'll be able to find up-to-date world events and news on our website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.